That's all.
Yeah, dude. That speaking of that, like, I'm sorry, but I don't know about you guys, but whenever I'm in spaces and I have to do my business, I like keep the phone unlocked and on the back of the on the top of the toilet, like the tank on the back, so I can watch that microphone to make sure that Twitter doesn't glitch out and unmute my mic and everybody hears my stream or whatever's going on.
You know. Thanks for that, man. Yeah. You know, and I just
don't trust the tech because Clubhouse used to do it.
Yeah. And you should not. Yeah. Cause I was having the issue with spaces last week where my mic was showing muted, but I was not muted.
Yep.
Which was interesting. It was doing the old reverse. And I'm just like, man, I'm really glad I wasn't doing something compromising, you know, during that period of time, like, you know, beating the dog like I usually do during spaces or something like that, you know, or, you know, cussing at my neighbors out the window, you know.
Or getting intimate with your wife.
You know, yeah. You know, it's, I mean, what else do you do when you're listening to spaces? But, yeah, some of them are pretty boring. I'm just going to put it to you like that. I mean,
there was one earlier that Shane and I were talking about before you guys all got in. The part of it. And I was like, I got to leave.
Yeah, man, I was in one of those earlier. I guess that was today. The days are kind of blending right now. But yeah, there was one and they were just, I'm not going to say what it was, but they were talking about some stuff. I said, I need to get out of this one pretty quick because just me being in there is going to put me on another damn list that I don't want to be on. So yeah, I dropped out of that one pretty quick.
Did I ever show you guys the list of labels that Twitter has on my account? Because like in the early days of Grok, you could, with the right prompt engineering, you could actually get Grok to like show you all the labels and the percentages of the labels and everything. I've got 62 damn labels on my account. Wow. Like not safe for work, like medical misinformation, like all this stuff. I was just like, what the hell is going on?
Nice work. Oh.
It's yeah, like you said, good work, man. Like if you're not on every list possible, what are you doing with your life,
right? Apparently
they should give you badges for that stuff to put on your profile, you know.
That would be dope. Like if Elon's listening, like let us put badges on our Twitter accounts, like 4 years plus of shadow ban, like perpetual, like I wear that with pride.
Earn that stuff, man. Yeah, I think Noster, I haven't tried it yet, but they have some type of an assessment that they'll do, like a profiling that they'll do of you based on what you've posted on there so far. But it's, you know, they don't try to hide it from you or anything. And it's, I mean, apparently it's been roasting some people pretty bad. So I've not gone through that gauntlet yet.
That would be kind of cool, actually, now that I think about it, is like if a social media platform had like you could earn titles for like the things that you post or the conversations that you are consistently involved in. Like I'm thinking of like the old MMOs I used to play where like if you heal enough people, you get known as like a combat healer and stuff like that. Like that'd be funny as hell to have like the titles on your profile.
Hey, why not? I mean, they're collecting the data. They might as well do something fun with it, right?
Right. Professional arguer or like perpetual reply guy.
Yeah, they are not good marketers, I will tell you that. Yeah. No original thoughts whatsoever.
That's true. Yeah. DEI, thanks a lot, Obama.
Right.
What a jerk.
That guy, man. He just haunts us.
You mean the female one or the never mind. They're both
Big Mike. Dude, what a state where, you know, whether it's true or not, man, you know, she's built like a linebacker, whatever your feelings are on the whole thing, which I think most people are like, maybe, like, it's not outside the realm of possibility. But it's so much
possible.
It's so much fun to just even like consider and throw out there, and you know, the reaction is obviously bipolar, right? You've got, oh my God, I can't believe you do that. You're racist. You're, you know, homophobic, whatever it is. And then you got the other side that just like cracks up.
Well, it is funny though, because like you look at like historical figures, like even just past presidents, and there's a lot of them that had some weird and or not socially acceptable pleasures in their routines in their day-to-day lives. And most people, like, you bring them up and they're like they'll just chalk it up as nonsense because it's not in the textbooks, right?
Yeah.
Look at, I don't know, look up a guy named J. Edgar Hoover, for instance. Man, he was into some interesting stuff. I'm glad he's not around anymore, because he'd probably be sending black choppers down to my house right now. But that guy, you know, I'm just going to say, look him up. He was into some interesting things. And all right, man, we're already getting here. But
oh, let's go.
Yeah. But I mean, if you haven't read Whitney Webb's stuff, get into that. And they'll talk about that entire blackmail industry that they have set up, where they're creating opportunities for people to get involved in things. I mean, obviously, we know. I mean, I'll just say Epstein. It's all over the place anyway. But
that's just one.
Yeah, that's just one person. But I mean, when you've got the director of the federal BI out there, and they've got so much dirt on this pervert that it's unreal. He's obviously working for somebody else, but it's fascinating. And then when you look at the impact that had on his war on organized crime and the ones that they let go and the ones that they went after, it's just amazing. I mean, the way that it shaped our judicial system and the criminal class in our country is just it's pretty cool stuff.
By cool, we mean
it's terrifying. Yes, because to think that those important decisions are made based on who has dirt on whom, man, it's some scary stuff.
Well, yeah, and yeah, I mean, the idea that the entire federal police force was started and run and indoctrinated by a cross-dressing homosexual that threw outlandish parties, right? Like, it's I mean, listen, guys, I went to Shane Gillis over the weekend. Fantastic, by the way. Highly recommend, if anybody gets a chance, to go see Shane Gillis live. His new set is killer. But in his last special out there, where he's like, oh yeah, you know what's terrifying is when you know the Vikings are coming around, and what if they were gay, right? It's like, oh yeah, man, here they come. They're gonna rape you know the daughters and the wives and all that. And then they raise like the little rainbow flag, and he goes,
oh, oh shit. Yeah. Oh, man. They want anything to do with them. It's just all us.
That's it, man. gotta conquer the straight whites.
Oh man.
Are we still here?
The cool part about like that information that I will agree with Gabe, though, is like just finding like the hidden stuff, right? Like the forbidden knowledge is always like, that's the really fun stuff. But then you got to be careful and make sure you don't go down the forbidden side of getting into like, you know, the Satanism and blood rituals and all that other crap, because now all that stuff's getting drawn up too.
Yeah.
Oh, buddy, we are going to have such a good time tonight. Alex Spetsky, I think the most anticipated guest we've ever had on the show. We've tried to do this one like three times at least.
Three times a time.
Here we are. See you, man. I think we're going to have a good time. Yeah, look, we got Old Salt out there. We got Lisa Huff out here getting ready to go. Man,
what's up, Lisa?
I think it's about that time. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right, hold on your butts. Bitcoin Veterans is coming. Let's go. Hey, this is Bitcoin Veterans. I'm Shane Hazel, your host. I got Mike Hobart and Gabe with me tonight. Our guest tonight is the one and only Alex Spetsky, which we will follow up with here in a second. We like to pay the bills around here, but Bitcoin Veterans is one of those places that we're looking to put everybody back on a mission, give you some passion. I said this, I think, last week when it was with me and Mike, and one of the greatest gifts in the world that you can give anybody is a real mission, something to have purpose in this world. And behind the scenes, Bitcoin Veterans is a lot bigger than what you see here on the show. We have a gigantic group that is getting even more gigante as time goes by, with little sects of veterans popping up and looking to do some work in this Bitcoin space. And I got to tell you, to see all of it between Operation Bitcoin, the Citadel Network, the what we've got going on in mining, the entire tech side of this that, you know, a lot of us big crayon-eating, knuckle-dragging fools are good at, you know, hopefully protecting these guys with the 12-pound brains. If you've got a itch and you need some action to put something to work and you need a group of guys that's Bitcoin and knows their stuff, this is the group for you. You don't have to be a veteran. You can go to bitcoinveterans.org and we will get you tuned up into the chats and get you started. And from there, just hold on, because I'll tell you, it's kind of like a wild Mustang. You just kind of grip it and let it go. And it's pretty amazing. But let's talk about our sponsors a little bit, pay some bills, and we'll be right back.
Black Sheep Ammunition. Veteran-owned and operated, Black Sheep Ammunition graciously donated 6,000 rounds to Bitcoin veterans for the Nashville Range Day event. Use Bitcoin 10 for 10% off. Black Sheep Ammunition is not made for the faint of heart. They craft ammo for the black sheep, for the watchful defenders called to hunt, provide, and protect, and for the brave patriots who boldly keep watch atop the hill, and for the weirdos who aren't afraid to stray from the flock. When courage calls you to action, Black Sheep will be there to answer. Their mission is to supply every freedom-loving American with enough firepower to get the job done twice. Check them out at blacksheepammo.com. Use the code Bitcoin10 for 10% off.
Solo Satoshi is dedicated to the advancement of open source Bitcoin mining with a steadfast commitment to the security and decentralization of the Bitcoin network. As a pioneering force in the Bitcoin space, your mission is to empower individuals and businesses worldwide with innovative, secure, and decentralized mining solutions. At Solo Satoshi, they believe in the transformative power of open source software and the potential it holds for the future of Bitcoin mining. They strive to foster a community of developers and enthusiasts who share our vision of a more secure and decentralized Bitcoin landscape. Our dedication to open source principles is at the heart of their mission, driving their commitment to transparency, collaboration, and innovation. They are passionate about supporting the growth and the development of the Bitcoin network, and they recognize the critical role that open source software and developers play in achieving this goal. By promoting and contributing to open source ecosystems, they aim to facilitate a more robust and resilient Bitcoin network, ensuring its longevity and success for years to come. At Solo Satoshi, their mission is not only to provide cutting-edge mining solutions, but also to educate and inspire others about the importance of decentralization and open source principles in the Bitcoin space. They believe that by working together, we can create a future where Bitcoin mining is more accessible, efficient, and aligned with the core values of decentralization and open collaboration.
All right, back to the show. Thank you to our sponsors. Go check them out. Like their pages and give them some love. They do a lot for us over here at Bitcoin Veterans, and I got to tell you, you know, we've got so many of these guys lined up right now, and it's promising to say the least. But our guest tonight is the one and only Alex Svetsky. If you guys don't know, Alex is actually the first Bitcoiner that reached out to me and said, "Hey, dummy, you might want to learn some of this Orange Coin stuff." And you know, years later, I think I finally did. But he is the author of the best-selling Uncommunist Manifesto, an upcoming Bushido Bitcoin. In 2018, he launched the world's first Bitcoin-only savings app, Amber. He recently had open sourced the first Bitcoin LLM, the Spirit of Satoshi, and is now working on Nostr-enabled travel and community social networks. What is it? Satlantis is what it's called.
Satlantis. That's right. Yes.
Cool. Man, it is always good to hang out with you. It's good to see you again, Alex. And, we're just, tickled to death to have you on.
Thanks, man. It's been a while. I think the last time we caught up was, I think in Miami a couple years ago. So yeah, man, it's been too long.
Too long for sure. Man, you're always a busy guy. Like you are a producer of so much content, whether it's the Bitcoin Times or, you know, Amber, or, you know, books that you're putting out or podcasts. you are just a monolithic, you know, in terms of going out here and creating content for this Bitcoin space. And I got nothing but respect for it. I think more and more people need to get on this. There's always room in Bitcoin because there's all these niches, and you've really kind of taken on this niche now where you're looking past, you know, what happens when we get into a Bitcoin type of society, you know, where we've actually crossed the Rubicon and there's no going back, and, you know, where are we going? And I think it's a great question, because if you're not planning 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years down the line, what are you actually doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You get to a point when you've been down the Bitcoin rabbit hole where, you know, you along the way you think, I'm never going to get over this. And like, there's so many things to learn, et cetera. But about 18 months ago or so, maybe even a little bit longer, I think I found, maybe not the end of the rabbit hole, it's probably not the right way to put it, but I found a point at which I was just like done with all the Bitcoin content. Like I'd heard it all, seen it all. Like, I didn't need to hear another history of money or why fiat money is, you know, ruining the world and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, I get it. And I think I don't say that to disparage any of that content. I mean, I produced over 1 million words of like writing that content, but just for me personally, I wanted to turn my gaze elsewhere. And like, couple that with obviously all the madness that happened over 2020, 2021, 2022, I think a lot of us spent time probably initially really rejecting everything. And being angry about it. And I know I was one of those ones. I was like yelling, bitching, screaming, whether it was on Twitter or getting arrested on airplanes because I refused to put my mask on and all this sort of shit. Like, so I kind of did all that. And then we kind of went into a phase of like just laughing at the stupidity, right? Like, we went from rage to ridicule. And once again, I kind of felt like I reached a crescendo of that stage of emotion. And writing this book for me has been more about transforming myself as a person and my gaze. Like, when I started writing the book, the idea originally came about when Eric Kaysen and I, we did a podcast by the name Bushido of Bitcoin, and this was in 2022. It was around the time when I had just launched the Uncommunist Manifesto and the print editions of the Bitcoin Times. And we kind of threw around this idea. We discussed that it was inspired by a book by James Clavell called Shogun, which is now a series. And granted, they actually did a good job with the series. Thank Christ they didn't. It's like one of the rare few ones that's not woke. And anyway, what we discussed on that podcast was sort of the relationship between Bushido as this concept of feudal Japan or late stage feudal Japan, which was basically a code of conduct for warriors, or a moral code or a code of virtue, whatever you want to call it, and how Bitcoin seemed to be creating one of its own. And the original incarnation of the book was something more like that. And it was supposed to be a light book, maybe 20, 25,000 words. To give you an idea, the book is now 142,000 words. It's like, it's five books in one, and it's like broken up into five books basically within the larger thing. And even from the edition that I sent you, it's evolved significantly since then. I think the edition I sent you was still around like the 900k words. Like, it's evolved, and it's been like, I shared it around with like some people like Lynn Alden and stuff like that. I got a bunch of feedback, and I really added to it. But anyway, kind of where I'm going with this, before I get off on all sorts of tangents, is my sort of coming to the point of having heard everything on Bitcoin, coming to the point of, you know, moving beyond ridicule and thinking about what's next, and also the act of writing the book and doing the research that I needed to do, like looking at all of the ancient cultures, you know, the Macedonians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Christendom of the medieval age, and particularly I really enjoyed like going down the rabbit hole of the Japanese, and also like how the Japanese warriors and the Vikings, like the parallels that they had, all this sort of stuff. And then I got into Nietzsche, then I got into a bunch of other things, and slowly, my gaze lifted. And the book transformed from its first incarnation, which was looking at the virtues that were emerging in Bitcoin. And I was like, no, fuck that. That's not that interesting. The second one was kind of like beating modernity over the head. And that was kind of like as I was going through the ridicule phase of the world. And I think that was probably the third draft. Like going back and reading the third draft the other week, I saw sort of like this sense of kind of like sarcastic despair almost, like just pointing out how the past was so much better than where we are now. And then this final incarnation of the book, particularly the last like draft 6, 7, and now we're on draft 8, almost done, is way more ascendant. Like you read the book and you want to go, you literally want to go run through fucking walls. You want to like go and bench press a fucking ton, like whatever, like you feel different. And that's basically where the book's gone. And to tie it back to your original comment, and sorry, I took up so much time here, but basically, yes, this is a book about what's next. And there's even a short story in here about the year 2084. Like, so everything is about the future. I don't give a fuck about now. I don't care about the next decade. I care about the next 100 years, and that's what this book's about.
Why 2084?
Partially arbitrary. I needed the entire book itself has got nothing to do with 2084. The entire book is like history, philosophy, psychology, you know, and setting up for the future. But towards the end, there's a section. So, like as I said, the book's broken up into 5 books essentially. So there's the prelude, there's Origins, which is like a history and parallels and the samurai and how they emerge and everything. Then like the big meaty chunk of the book is the virtues. Then there is the section called integration, which breaks up the 4 big pillars: culture, governance, wealth, and seasons and cycles, and then relate how Bitcoin helps those. Then I've got a whole book on praxis. So the practice, training, physiopsychology, mastery, pain, rites of passage, all this sort of stuff.
Hell yeah.
And then finally, what the future holds. And where the idea for the story came was in What the Future Holds, I started writing about, you know, all of these models like meritocratic feudalism and aristocracy and all this sort of like crazy ideas that I have about how the world's going to be structured in the future. And then my editor was like, dude, don't tell, show, tell me a story. And that's actually opened up a whole new area that I've never done in my life before, is actually write a story. And fuck, I'm telling you, I've got the sickest story. And I placed it in the year 2084. I don't know why, but yeah, maybe it's got something to do with 1984 and it's 100 years later.
It is like a century after 1984, so it seems quite relevant.
Yeah. So anyway,
I'm stoked, man. I'm sure you guys noticed I was looking at my screen for the last like 5-10 minutes and I was ordering your book. Like, I'm looking forward to getting that copy, man. Especially between the virtues, which I would like, if you're willing, I would like to hear what the virtues are that you have listed in the book, and then talking about getting into that future of 2084, because like I think one of the things that makes it relevant and one of the reasons why maybe you did subconsciously tie it in is that without the warrior class, 1984 is all but like guaranteed to come about.
Should we roll the video?
Yes.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's do it. Thank you. damn.
Damn. Like, yeah.
That's like pre-workout right there.
Yeah. It really is. Honestly, I was watching that before I went to the gym for like the first week.
That'll do it. Damn. Man, and it's such an important topic because we're already seeing signs of the risk that Bitcoiners can fall into that exact same trap as everybody else. 100%. 'Cause what happens when you become the group of people that is in control? What happens when you, I mean, if you want to see a person's true nature, what do they say? You know, give them power. And I mean, that's what we're going towards. And so we know that Bitcoin is going to win. And we know how it's going to happen, but exactly, I mean, that is the question, you know, what's everybody going to behave like when it does happen? There you go. I just summarized that video for you in case you needed it, but it is, I think it's so relevant right now because we already see the signs, and I know it's kind of a joke, and I know a lot of it is, you know, as you use the word ridicule, and people have their memes and they say there will be signs and, you know, they got everybody's Lambos and all that other stuff, but you know, that's not, none of that stuff matters. None of that stuff is important. And I think that I know that that's something that we embrace among the Bitcoin veterans community is that this is more than just about money. This isn't mm-hmm. just about getting rich. This isn't just about telling everybody else, hey, look, we won and you lost. We got all the money now and you don't, you know, have fun staying poor losers. It's more than about that. I think this is right on time. This is awesome.
I appreciate it.
Alex, would you mind giving us kind of like a synopsis? It doesn't have to be all of them, but maybe like some of the core values or virtues that you had mentioned that you have included in the book that you talk about.
Yeah. actually, before I even do that, you just mentioned something really important, which I think is it's a distinction that not many people realize rationally speaking, but they get it biologically speaking or viscerally speaking, is there's a difference between virtue and value. So values are things that you desire. And this is something as I was writing the book, really hit me. Like there's a section in there called freedom is not a virtue. Like freedom is a value and it is derived by acting out the virtue of responsibility. So freedom is actually downstream of that. And this is a big thing that I talk about in the book is I say, look, virtue comes first. Like even before, like virtue is even upstream to morality. Because one could argue that different cultures and different religions, et cetera, have a different framework of morality. But I can tell you one thing, courage is a virtue that is recognized by all cultures and all religions and all people. Like it's almost biological. Like when you see something and you know that it was courageous, you can't help but feel it. You know, like even as I'm talking about it, like I feel chills, right? So that integrity, you know that transcends the usual morality. Now, the line is not so clear cut. Like I had a discussion with Jimmy Song the other day, and you know he was trying to make the opposite argument. He was like, "No, morality comes first, then virtue comes second." And I was like, "No, I don't think so. Like it feels to me like the virtue is very hard to lie about. Like so, if you know you've got, I can very quickly tell." That someone like Greta Thunberg, right, or Bill Gates, let's use him as an example. Like he doesn't live by the virtue of restraint or self-control. Otherwise, he wouldn't be fat, right? Like so I can see whether he lives by virtue or not. But he can sit there and say all the things about morality and why he's a good person and why he should help everyone and all this sort of stuff. Now, granted, we can also see his lack of morality too. So maybe that's not the best example, but you kind of get what I mean, right? Like yeah. It's very hard to lie about that. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. Like there is the fundamental difference between virtue and value. Virtue is what you do and it's the action. It's the action-oriented element which helps you attain the things that you value, whether freedom, peace.
Or protect them.
Etc. Yeah. Exactly. And protect them. Exactly.
I say that independence is a verb. And like you cannot expect to be free or independent if you haven't done the work to be free and independent. Mm-hmm. And that's a colossal mountain to climb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I use independence as an example in the responsibility chapter where I basically say that the independence is some blend of freedom and responsibility. Like, it's when those two things come together, like, it's independence that actually matters. It's not, it's, and it's also, there's another distinction I use in the book that I'm thinking of now. It's like, people don't want absolute freedom. What they want is autonomy, which is another word for basically independence. Absolute freedom is meaningless. Like, it's just like, it's molasses, it's chaos. It's, there's no guidelines. There's no restrictions. You know, people say, oh, I need to be creative, so I need to be completely free. No, like, believe it or not, like, restrictions or barriers actually force creativity, because it's, you have a framework within which to be creative on. So it's that. That's a really important distinction that you brought up, Shane. I just want to sort of echo that, is independence is the key.
Which is like what you just said with the restrictions to kind of like facilitate the creativity is precisely what the Stoics argued, because that restriction would be the discipline. Like, you don't just chase all of your pleasures in some hedonic like lifestyle. You're not gonna end up achieving anything, because you're just constantly seeking pleasure for pleasure's sake, and like then you're essentially throwing aside another thing that you were talking about. With like the freedom being really kind of like downstream of the virtue of responsibility, because you have to take on the responsibility for yourself. And if you have a family, but you have to take on the responsibility for yourself and for them, and the responsibility of taking care of them and providing for them and yourself in order to actually have that freedom.
Mm-hmm. Correct. In fact, I've always, for the last year, I've been saying this, or the last 2 years, in fact, and this was also another reason why, like, I wrote this article years ago for Bitcoin Magazine called Bitcoin is Responsibility Go Up Technology, right? So it's like, you know, I was trying to like start this movement, and it was funny. It was the least read article. Nobody gave a fuck. And I was like, really? So in this book, round two,
I've got responsibility.
I know, right? Yeah. In the book, I've got like a whole, like, one of my favorite chapters is responsibility. So I open up with like the absence of responsibility. Then I talk about agency as the animating force of life, and how NPCs lack agency. Then I talk about the psychology of responsibility, and I introduce everybody to a psychologist that is long forgotten, who's called Alfred Adler. And I think of him as the Austrian economics equivalent of psychology. It's the forgotten school, and you guys will love that one. Then I talk about the energy of responsibility, then freedom is not a virtue, and then I finish up with like rights and responsibilities and what that all means. But in the book, and as I said, for the last couple of years I've been talking about this, is if you want to take away people's freedoms, you don't do it overtly by taking away their freedoms. First, you take away slowly the things they're responsible for. And then you don't have to worry about the freedoms, because once you renounce your responsibility to said thing, you no longer have the freedom over said thing, right? So like you like, if I put my money in the bank, I'm not free to do whatever I want with my money, because I've given the responsibility to the bank to hold the money, right? So I was the other week, actually, a friend of my wife's asked about Bitcoin. And I mean, I don't talk to anybody about Bitcoin anymore these days, but she knew for whatever reason, and was asking about like self-custody and things like that. And I was explaining like how the wallets work, and you know, what happens if you lose your keys, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, it just struck me once again, you know, typical normies, like the comment was, oh wow, that's really scary. I wouldn't trust myself to, I mean, at least she was honest. She's like, I wouldn't trust myself to hold my own keys because I will lose them. And what I kind of replied to her was, look, that's the price of freedom. That, like, the price of freedom is responsibility, and not having somebody to bail you out afterwards, and not having somebody else to fix you. In many ways, that is the that is actually what leads to maturity. And the older I've gotten, like, I look back on my 20s, and I was the classic kid, like, freedom maximalist, fuck you, fuck everybody, everything is my choice, I'll do whatever I want. Now, I was never lefty liberal, but I was just like, man, I just didn't have the ability to know, like, where there was a sensible line. And man, I've done all sorts of stupid shit and been in trouble for all sorts of things. And now that I'm a little bit older and maybe half as stupid, I've started to appreciate that, yeah, freedom is not so, it's not all it's made out to be. And in many ways, like, this is why I've moved away from the libertarian movements and all this sort of stuff. It's like, everything is so freedom, liberty oriented. And it's just so childish. Like there's something deeper. There's something more fundamental than that. And freedom is just a consequence of it all. And yeah, this is actually a big reason why I wanted to jump on the call with you guys, is that as veterans, as people who have sort of lived the lives that you guys have lived, you appreciate that everything is not all fucking sunshine and roses. Like, it's not like, oh yeah, we're going to create a libertarian utopia and no state. Like, it just doesn't fucking work like that, right? It's all bullshit. Like, and these like libertarians are completely out of their minds. Like, in my opinion, most Bitcoiners are also out of their minds in terms of like their fantasies. And I've just sort of moved away from that in time and realized that there's these, yeah, more fundamental things, these virtues, once again, responsibility being a key one, self-control and restraint, respect, excellence, honor, courage, justice, like all these sorts of things come well before freedom. You know, we don't have the justicarian political movement, right? We don't have the responsibilitarian movement. Like, they're more important than libertarian.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, sorry, Shane, to your point, just real quick, like the warrior code, like if you're going to live by the warrior code, like you're sacrificing some of your ultimate freedoms to agree to carry yourself and act in a specific way that is agreeable by your brothers in arms. That's all I wanted to add, Shane. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I mean, you talked about, you know, money and banks kind of giving that up and not having that as a responsibility of your own. You know, there's a ton of other things, you know, if you want to be independent, quote unquote free, you know, you have to put in the work. It's your food. Are you sourcing your own food? Are you outsourcing your food? Are you sourcing your education or outsourcing education for you and your kids? Are you outsourcing your security, or do you have that pretty well underhand with, you know, whether it's you and your family or a group of people within, your community? Do you have that taken care of? Tangible skills. Are you farming out your tangible skill sets, like especially around the house? Like if you don't know how to do, you know, normal auto repair and maintenance and things like that, and then, you know, home repair, I'm not saying you can't, but like in a pinch, having those skill sets, you know, amongst a various group of other things, I think that is super important that you highlight that there's so much proof of work that goes into what everything in terms of Bitcoin, you know, fantasy is predicting, right? Is like, guys, you don't get to hang up your work boots when we cross this Bitcoin Rubicon. Like, if anything, you better strap up and strap on, because it is going to be survival of the fittest. And I think that's probably a really interesting, you know, point to jump off into, you know, another question. And Gabe, I swear to God, I'll shut up after this. You know, I see a very dark period ahead for the human species, right? Like we're up against some things that we don't really understand. I don't think that have, you know, you're not privy to a lot of the information. But I do understand kind of the cycles of what goes on in history, and we're at that inflection point almost now, right? You know, we're seeing, the people who like to censor come out of the woodwork. We're seeing, you know, all of this come out of the woodwork. I'd be curious as to, you know, the warrior cultures that you've really paid attention to, the samurai, the Romans, what do you draw from those populations of warriors that's going to help us get through, this transition period from, you know, a fiat standard into a Bitcoin standard?
Good question. Obviously the virtues as a basic thing. But instead of hopping on about that, because I think that's obvious at this point, is like these warrior cultures established and developed these virtues for a reason, and that is to establish and build a cohesive, strong, powerful, integrated culture, because a warrior culture sort of lives at the edge of life and death, and they need to have the strongest possible culture to survive. But beyond that, I think one of the things I talk about in the book, I talk a lot about war and peace, and I kind of frame peace more as a vice than anything else. I kind of talk about peace as the intermission or the period between activity. It's not something to aspire to. It's something to use before your next period of war or battle or conflict, right? And I think the premise that we're all going to make a bunch of money, everything's going to be okay, I think is false. I also don't think everything's going to completely fall apart and we're going to have zombies and we're going to be cannibalizing each other and eating each other and all that sort of shit. I don't think sort of either of those extremes are real. But somewhere within that range, the world will find itself, right? And depending on where you are, depending on what you know, depending on what other things you've developed around you, you may need to fight. And whether that is physical fight, whether that is an intellectual fight, a psychological fight, whether that is familial, whether that is community, whether that is whatever, the capacity for violence or the capacity to attack and not just fucking wait to defend, but sometimes like you need to take the initiative and take the hill. Because if you don't, you leave room for the enemy to take that hill, and then you are playing defense. You are on the back foot. So I think that's one of the things, like the most successful warrior cultures took massive initiative and were not afraid to be violent. So one story I might use here is when Alexander and his army defeated Darius the second time, Darius obviously fled again. And in the process of fleeing, one of his generals basically betrayed him, backstabbed him, made him a prisoner, and decided to take on the Persian army himself with the idea of getting reinforcements and coming back and taking out Alexander, or potentially selling Darius to Alexander. But, you know, unbeknownst to him, Alexander didn't see things that way. He's like, this is a traitor and I don't do business with a traitor. So he went after them, and man, they covered more territory in 11 days than any army since, with cars or without fucking cars. Nobody has ever crossed that amount of space in the history of humanity since. And that kind of initiative really set him apart. Like, he was able to go and do things that other men were not willing to do. Like when they had to meet armies, and I can't remember if this was the Persians or, you know, during the Afghan period, but basically he went and he crossed his army over the Hindu Kush in the winter, right? When everybody else was like, this is madness, like nobody would ever do this, they crossed in the winter to take the initiative, to have the capacity to get the higher ground or to get the better position, everything like that. Speed, initiative, and ultimately, as I said, the capacity for violence. So I think I think there's many other things here that I could mention, but I think that one specifically, and it's just a recurring theme in the book, whether it's like at the end of the book, I've got this section on the metaphysics of war and beauty, where I talk about freedom and war. I talk about the eternal battle, like everything from the moment that we are basically in the process of procreation, like the sperm that's swimming up the canal is in a war and a battle with the acids in that canal to survive and to be the only one that makes it. And then when it makes it, you know, the battle that the embryo has to become a living being, and then the battle that, you know, it gets ripped out of the womb and goes from a liquid environment to an oxygen environment, and it's like traumatic rite of passage fundamentally. So it's like all of these things are violent in nature, and I think our relationship to violence has basically become characterized by the same relationship we have when we buy meat at the supermarket, right? Like, it's violence is sort of like hidden, it's out of sight, and like nobody talks about it. You know, like the extent of the violence we experience is like, oh my God, look, there's a video on Twitter, and it's like, you know, people yelling at each other. Oh my God, it's so violent. Like, I had someone the other day like reach out to me and be like, oh my God, someone attacked me on, like, it was one of my staff, bless her, she's, you know, beautiful soul, but she got attacked on Noster, and she's like, I've never had anyone attack me. I'm like, I'm panicking. And I was like, relax, there's trust me, there's much worse things in life. Like, so it's like that desensitivity to violence, pain, struggle, sacrifice, all of that sort of stuff, I think is probably the best answer I can give you in the limited time we have.
Man. You know, that's it's interesting how we use the word attack so regularly. You know, this person was attacked on social media. No, that's not an attack. Somebody said something mean about you that doesn't even know you. And there's no real damage that you can't recover from. when it comes to that. And it's interesting because language is important. Obviously the words that we use, they matter. And you talked about the abdication of responsibility that so many people are so willing to engage in. Because without that responsibility, there's this superimposition of this false notion of freedom, because mm-hmm. you're not responsible for those things anymore. But what you're really doing is it's not about freedom. It's about the control that you're giving up that you have over your own life. Because if you're not responsible for something, if you give up that responsibility to another entity or anything else, then they now have control over you. So I'm curious what you've learned in your studies of the virtues of these other cultures that we're talking about. I'm curious what you've discovered as far as the role of community in these different cultures. What has stood out to you as far as that goes, as far as, rituals, rites of passage, the roles of those different elements in those virtuous cultures that you've been researching?
Yeah, beautiful question. I mean, in the praxis part of the book, there's a whole series of chapters on rites of passage, and I look at traditional rites, modern rites. Then I go into a section called Slaying the Inner Dragons, which is a discussion on vice, because as much as virtue is that which you orient towards and you move towards, vice is that which you must keep at bay as best as you can. And one of the mechanisms that I discuss about dealing with vice, and just a mechanism for also establishing virtue, is this idea of the Mannerbund, which means the band of men or the brotherhood, or the alliance of men is probably the more accurate term. And this basically ties into community, right? But it's a gender-based community because men and women are fundamentally different. And I make a point of that in the book, is like much of my book is written for men. Women can read it for sure, but they're not going to relate to it in the same way as the five of us will, or the four of us, because we are men. We're biologically different, and we adapt to things differently. We understand things differently. We view things differently. Like all of that sort of stuff is unique to the biological makeup of men. And it's funny, I spoke about this with my wife the other day, because we had a bit of an argument. She asked me, why is it always, we went to this pet store. Can I get un-PC here?
Oh yeah.
Oh okay. Yeah. All right. We went to a pet store, and lo and behold, the person at the cashier is a complete tranny. And I was like, oh, for the love of Christ. So, my wife comes out afterwards. She's like, why do these people always work at pet stores? And I was like, do you want to know the truth? And like, the little devil on my shoulder was like, tell the truth. Now, I I love animals, but I'm not much of a pet guy, right? And I think in many ways, the rise of pets has been an unhealthy function of how devoid civilization is of a relationship to other humans and their own fucking kids.
Yeah.
And it pisses me off. And anyway, I said that to her. Now, she is a woman, and he loves her dog. And she took it personally, and stupid me for not thinking that, a couple steps further. But anyway, we get into this whole fucking argument, right? And afterwards, she's telling me something. She's like, sometimes you're just so arrogant. You think you're better than people. And I was like, well, yeah, because I am. And she's like, we get into this like other argument. But my point was, and I tried to like coach her on this. I said, look, you're not going to understand. I said, you're a woman. And what you don't understand is men play status games. Women do to some degree as well, but men live and die by status. The reason we go and get money is for status. The reason we go to war, the reason we go to mission, the reason we do all this sort of shit that we do as crazy men, like we do stunts, we drive fast, we do all this kind of crap, is to establish status, particularly among the men that we respect. Or yeah. That whose respect we want to also gain, right?
Yes.
And this is once again unique to men, and women just can't understand this because they're more egalitarian. They're like, oh, you're so beautiful. No, you're so beautiful. Like with guys, it's like, bro, you look like a fucking idiot. It's like, oh, thanks, bro. Let me change my shirt, right? So it's like, it's completely different worlds. So anyway, I've a bit of a tangent here to come back to your question about communities. Like, I see that as absolutely fundamental. I might read a passage here from the book. So
go for it.
I say, we're in a fight for the soul of man, and we need all the best men possible. If you're not in an environment that pushes you to be the best, if you find yourself alone, frustrated, or perpetually online, then it's time to venture out and literally construct this Manorbund in real life. Get off Twitter and go to a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu dojo. Go hunting or camping with a group of men and build a bond. Take it upon yourselves to build an all-male bar or an all-male fight club, or gym, sorry. Go build a business or a house together. Get physical, do something dangerous. Use technology where applicable to feed your mind and connect with like-valued men, not like-minded. And then I say these online connections can turn into offline tribes, but you have to move beyond the keyboard. And that basically, yeah, just ties into this idea of community. And to sort of just make one last connection is Christianity did this quite well over many centuries, is they used the church as sort of like the centerpiece of community in order to help people deal with vice. In fact, even less so than inspiring them to virtue. It was more about like confessing your sins and doing all that sort of stuff, but they used community as a mechanism for that. So fundamentally, like you look at the way the modern world functions, it's inverted. Like the attack is on communities, and the push is that we're all in this together as a whole fucking 7 billion people, which we're not. We're different racially, ethnically, intellectually, morally, values-wise. Like, we're different in so many fucking ways, it's not even funny. But apparently at the global level, we're in this together, while at the community level, go fuck yourself, right? So it's inverted. And we need to like revert that into the right orientation, and community is fundamentally central to that. And like I bash on about that in here, like in the culture chapter, in the governance chapter, I talk about tribalism and territory and how territory is a fundamental biological driver that actually sits upstream even of sex. Like there's a whole book by Robert Ardrey called The Territorial Imperative, which will like blow your fucking minds. He's like the Austrian economics equivalent of anthropology that no one likes to talk about as well. So like I've got all of this stuff in there, but anyway, I'll shut up there. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's completely right. And it's interesting that today, if you do view things in an inverted way like that, and you talk about that, then you're seen as being isolationist or, xenophobic and hating everybody else. But the strongest societies and the most virtuous, successful cultures are the ones that they focused on what was going on inside their own perimeter. And that's who they looked out for first, because who can possibly bear the burden of being responsible for everybody on the entire planet, of having to worry about every single person on every single corner of the globe, and to even think that, even to have the arrogance to believe that you are the one who has to look out for everybody else. At the same time, you're missing what's right there in front of you. You're not looking out for your own tribe. Yeah, I think that's outstanding. And at the same time, people are outsourcing their masculinity by not engaging in their own communities. That's why, you know, televised sports are so popular with people, is because they'd rather watch other people do masculine than get out there and do it themselves. Man, that's fascinating. I can't wait to read this book.
Yeah, 100%. I think I want to mention one other thing that just that echoes exactly what you said, which is, When you're on a plane and the thing is going to crash, they tell you to put the mask on yourself first, right? Like, so you need to start with yourself first, right? Jordan Peterson talks about cleaning up your fucking room first. Now, I'm not a big fan of Jordan anymore. I think he's going all weird, but whatever. Like, the point still stands. You clean your own room first. You look after your own people first. And a great place, which, you know, funny enough, just from the left, this just gets a lot of hate. Funny that, is Dubai. Like, Dubai and the United Arab Emirates in general, they look after their own people first. Like, they're very open. Anybody can go there. Anybody can become a resident, but you cannot become a citizen. only the Emiratis hold citizenship. And as an Emirati, you get everything at half price. You get gas at half price. You get banking at half price. You get everything at half price. So you get looked after first as an Emirati because you are the citizen. You are the ethnic nation. Like the word nation actually means of shared birth. People don't fucking understand this stuff. But you are of shared birth in that territory. Everybody else is a guest. And when you go there, you sense that. They're extremely polite. They take care of you. You are a guest in their home, but you do not have the same rights as your the average Emirati. And you know the leftists will go on, oh yeah, but they got, you know, slavery and all this sort of shit. No, motherfucker, people go there from other broken countries so that they can earn some money because they're allowed in and they're not allowed fucking in anywhere else. So they go there, they earn some money, they live respectfully. If they break the fucking law, they just get chucked on a plane straight out, never allowed back in. Simple. Like, that is the way to run something. I've got a lot of respect for that. And that is literally an example of the correct community first, culture first, ethnicity first. Like, it does that and then everything else second versus the inverted shit show that we've had in the West. And if you really, really, really want to see the results of both, go watch a time lapse of Dubai from 1980 to now.
Yeah.
It was a fucking desert patch, and it's now a city metropolis in the middle of the desert. And in the same 40 years, San Francisco, who adopted the opposite philosophy, went from one of the greatest cities on earth to a fucking place where people take a shit on the corner and, you know, will not get arrested if they steal less than $900 worth of shit from the shop. There's your inversion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've done it at scale. That's the incredible thing. They've taken care of a population. They've got a thriving nation. I honestly, they're oil rich and energy rich at that. But
they're not actually that oil rich. Dubai's not oil rich. This is another, like, I mean, the UAE is, but Dubai is actually not oil.
Yeah,
rich.
Yeah,
trading port. But
yeah, you know, Dhabi, yeah, I was gonna say Abu Dhabi, the same nation, and they have scaled. You mentioned faith just a little while ago, and I was wondering, you know, in the future as we move through this, what is your practical application for, and not so much faith, but we'll call it faith, not religion, spirituality, within this Bushido, where, you know, where does it play the roles, and is it going to be prevalent, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Towards the end of the book, there's a section where I discuss, like, kind of what I said in the beginning, how virtue transcends morality and stuff like that. But virtue also transcends beliefs, right? Virtue transcends culture. Virtue transcends all of these things. Virtue is the thing that two people who might be enemies can notice in each other and respect. So a great example I use in the book actually is from the period of the Crusades, and it's not hitting me off the top of my head, but it was Saladin on the Islamic side, and I can't remember who was on the other side. But how, even in war, and Saladin is known to this day as one of the greatest Muslim conquerors in history, and he fought and he took back a lot of territory. After he died, that territory was given back and all this sort of shit. But the way he behaved, the honor he conducted himself with, was second to none, and he begrudgingly earned the respect of his enemies. Now, to me, virtue is the ability to look at even someone who might be your ideological enemy. I have a different belief. I'm Islamic, you're Muslim, you're Muslim, Christian, whatever, right? But to be able to ally around virtue and to know that is fucking vice that we're looking at there, and we can set our beliefs aside. You can have your beliefs as Christian, you can have your beliefs as Muslim, as whatever you want, but we can align around virtue. And that's kind of the call to action at the end of the book. I say, look, there's a lot of heat between libertarians and fucking conservatives and, you know, the Nietzscheans and the BAPs of the world and the dissident right and the Christians and the fucking all this sort of stuff, right? But there's a common thread that links us up, and I'm hoping that common thread is virtue or something like the 10 virtues that I've proposed here. And these, just to be very clear, it's like, these aren't Svetsky's virtues, right? Like, this is me having found some sort of pattern or some sort of overlap from the greatest civilizations. I didn't just pluck these out of my own asshole. Like, these are there, and they seem to be repeated over and over and over again by different cultures, each who achieved some degree of civilizational excellence of their own accord, right? Like I love, for example, how the samurai and the Western knights, with completely, like, that they were geographically completely distinct, genetically, biologically different, completely distinct. And they came up with the same feudal structure, with the same warrior class, and the same warrior class established the code of virtue, Bushido in the East, chivalry in the West, which basically mimicked at the same fucking time in human history. Like, that kind of stuff is mind-boggling. And that stuff is not accidental. That happens because it works. It happens because there's something there. And to sort of tie it back to your point about faith, like, faith kind of, like, you know, is a wrapper for all of this stuff. But the core thread to me remains something like virtue. And, you know, maybe some people get angry at me about this. Like, you know, Jimmy was not a big fan, you know, because he sort of, like, hates Nietzsche. And he's like, you know, you're betraying Christianity for, like, talking about Nietzsche. And I was like, well, no, because Nietzsche was actually right about a bunch of things. And there's, you know, there's a thread we can pull from there that makes a lot of sense. So it's not about dropping your faith. This isn't, like, I very specifically say in the book, this isn't a new religion. This isn't like you drop Christianity, now you're, you know, a Bushidoist. Like, doesn't work like that. This is a code that you can live by, that you can wrap with your spiritual beliefs, if we want to put it that way.
Solid answer. I mean, I wasn't looking for anywhere. I was actually leaving space for Mike and Gabe to jump here with the question. No, faith and spirituality is one of those things that I look at in terms of the warrior class, and it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter, you know, if you're a student of Islam or Christianity, or, you know, it doesn't. To me, that's not the piece that matters in the warrior class. The warrior class, you know, the outstanding warrior class is kind of, you know, one of those things. I think that it derives its own respect from the communities that it's in to begin with, right? It's like, it's just kind of the laws of nature. Like, if you steal from those guys, they're going to do extremely bad things to you one way or another. You, if you're young enough, maybe you'll just be taught a lesson. If you're inside the community, maybe it's not so severe. If you're outside the community, it could have, you know, obviously great ramifications. And you see things like kind of just bleeding over from just the natural strength of that type of group, where you're like, hey man, if you try to have an affair with that guy's wife, or you try to take his property, or you try, like, whatever the case is, like, you start to look at things from that virtuous point of view, like, oh hey, listen, this virtue is going to keep you and your family alive at some point. And I think that's very much a derivative of that warrior class that obviously is protecting a community.
Yeah, there's a high degree of accountability in that kind of an environment, and that's a big part of what these virtues represent, and then what that kind of community, to hit on Gabe's point from earlier, does, right? Like, this is one thing I've got a, you know, problem with, you know, many religions. They're very guilt driven, and warrior culture are actually shame driven, and that's different, because guilt is a little bit more internal, and guilt, in many ways, actually weighs you down. I think it's one of the potential or arguable weaknesses of Christianity. It's got many positive traits, but, like, the sort of the feeling of guilt in many ways is the reason why the West is collapsing today. Oh, we're guilty for colonizing. We're guilty for this. We're guilty for the Holocaust. We're guilty for this. We're guilty for everything. And now, all of a sudden, let's just let fucking everybody in, and let's destroy our country so that we can become like the Africans that we apparently, colonized, right? So, like, guilt, I don't think, is very healthy. Whereas shame is more like, you know, you warriors, like, kind of like what I said about the relationship between guys earlier, right? Like, you put a shirt on and it's like, bro, you look like a fucking dork. Take that off. Like, yeah. That kind of shaming works, and it's like, it's instant. And you don't sort of, like, it's not like God will judge me for the shirt that I'm wearing and I must now feel guilty or something like that. It's a different energy. And I think that's,
It's that really ridicule good. Between your peer group. And I mean, I'm sure you guys remember it well. I remember going through, RIP and you know, all the indoctrination and that stuff with peers, right? Like, these guys were peers and they were, you know, two-time volunteers. And if you didn't have your shit together, if you were getting fat or you, like, whatever the case was, you look like a bag of ass, your room, like, whatever it was going to be that you were the, you know, the liability instead of the asset, then, you know, the shame and the ridicule just was profound and well-deserved. Because if you're trying to uphold the standard, right. And that standard is, hey, we live and they die. And that's kind of, you know, the standard, like, how far can you take that? And that shame side of it is what absolutely keeps the greatest warriors and warrior tribes, I think, at the helm, is like, who upheld the virtues the highest and pushed it the farthest and said, hey, you know, this is the way we are. And if you don't like it, well, hey man, there's the road over there.
Yeah. Well, to Alex's point is, like, shame sparks or inspires action, while guilt, like, keeps the individual, like, at bay or, like, kind of, like, withheld. Right. Cause, like, when you're guilty, you don't want to act at all. But when you're, like, when you're shamed into something, like, hey man, we're going to go do this thing. If you're not out there helping us, like, something's going to happen. So, like, mm-hmm. you better get your ass up and get out there and join everybody, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like that. I'm going to paraphrase the quote, but something like, shame is a goad, like, to honor, right? Like, it goads people or a goading to action. And Alexander the Great, once again, is a person who used this to great effect. Is that there's a period where his soldiers wanted to turn back when he was on the trek and they were near India. Or perhaps even in India at this point. And he gets up and he shows, like, he strips naked and he shows that all of his scars are in the front of his body, nothing in the back, which means he's never running away. And he asks the armies, if anyone has been in the front lines more than I have, or if anyone has more scars to show than I have, and if anyone has more, please come and show me. And, like, he used that as basically a stick to prod them into continuing forward. And it's a very powerful tool. Obviously, you need to be careful not to use it too much. You know, as with all tools, psychological and spiritual, mental, and all this sort of stuff, like, you can take them to extremes. But it's clearly powerful. And we've, it's funny, it ties into Gabe's point earlier about, like, people are so, allergic to things like shame and being called out, etc. Like, they call someone yelling at them on Twitter an attack. I'm fucking freaked out now. Like, I'm gonna die because someone attacked me on Twitter. It's like, chill. Like, we need to make shame and bullying and stuff like that great again, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a standard. And it's, I mean, it sounds like that's what he was doing. He was like, check it out. All my scars are in the front. This is the standard. This is the way we do it here. We don't run, we go forward. Mm-hmm. And when mm-hmm. there isn't a standard, then, you know, then there are there's no expectation and there's no way forward. There's no path. And it's funny because, I mean, if I would say to anybody listening to this, if you're not in a group of people that are going to hold you to a standard, and they're going to call you out when you're not meeting that standard, you need to find a new group of people, because you need someone that's going to tell you that your shirt looks stupid, or you need someone to tell you that you're getting fat, or that you're getting weak, or that you're doing something stupid that, yes, you should be doing differently. Because, yeah, if everybody tells you, if everybody that you know tells you that you're great and that you're doing a good job, then your friends are a bunch of liars. All right.
Yeah,
and they want you to be weak because they're weak. So find a group of people that's going to bust you out and that's going to keep you held to the standard. Hey, I know we're kind of moving forward in time, but I'm curious. So we've got a lot of veterans that are listening to this and other non-veterans and just people that I believe that your message is going to resonate very, very strongly with. What would be a call to action that you would share with them as they're preparing their minds and looking for ways to live a more virtuous life?
Let me answer that by reading a little passage here, which ties into exactly what you said. It says, your band of brothers should be selected carefully. They are not merely those whom you've known the longest, and also not only those who are nice to you. In fact, beware of the latter, for a true friend will call you out when you're not living up to your potential. Your truest friends in that sense are those who might come off as assholes because they're unwilling to waver or to watch you violate your own standards. Just being in their presence is like a rite of passage. They are your reminder to wage war on vice, and you are there as you are their reminder. And then I've got a quote from a old essay, which is, those who want the best for you are by definition those who demand the best from you. These are your true friends. These are your community. These are the remnant. In order to be among them, you must be the best and most honest version of yourself. There is no greater aspiration in life. So I think that would be my call to action. Maybe I'll finish it with this. Your truest friends are the ones who would shed blood for you and you for them. They are the ones whom you can train with, whose family you would guard, and with whom you would feel safe leaving your family under the care of should something happen to you. They are those you practice and sharpen your wits with. So it goes sort of on and on about that sort of thing, but that would be my humble call to action for everyone.
That is outstanding. Thank you.
Very powerful. I mean, geez, OP, that's poetic even.
I told you, it's not a Bitcoin book. Like, there's no bullshit here about, history of money, and yeah, we used gold for 5,000 years. Who gives a fuck? The more important thing.
Yeah, and this is if this is any indication of how this book is going to read, it's probably going to be a repeat read for a lot of people, and for a good reason. I think there's so much that happens in this warrior type of culture that is great for society, that is great for community, that's great for creating that those periods of peace. You know, the stronger societies that you have that are upheld by virtue. And by a warrior code that wants to spend their time in the garden, not at war. I pray for these kind of things. It's like, let's do as much as we can to avoid it, but at the same time, do everything and then some to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. And, this group of guys, I got to tell you, Alex, we've found an amazing group here within Bitcoin Veterans, where we do a lot of these things. We go out and we suffer together. We go through spiritual learning. We go through the rigors of the elements together. And it's one of those things where, it's such a blessing where you see these guys go out into the elements and they suffer and they laugh in the face of it, hysterically sometimes, right? And they laugh together in the face of it. Yeah. And boy, what a treat to have, somebody, and then that's why Bitcoin Veterans is open to everybody, is because, somebody who hasn't, been in combat or in the military or whatever can lend so much just brilliant advice and practicality to this mission that we're all on. It's like, all right, guys, we've got an amazing technology at our fingertips right now. It's, virgin, and we really don't understand what we're planning. We know things are going to change. We know we're pushing things to change, but we don't know the path that we're all going to be on. And this is one of those that I think helps us in terms of navigating it.
100%. I think I was just laughing when you said the whole battling the elements together and laughing about it and shit like that. Like, women will never understand that. they'd look at that and like, what's wrong with these people? Like, why would anyone do that? And it reminds me of the the scene in 300 where the arrows go up and then they're fighting in the shade and they're laughing. Like, that kind of character is only really found in that warrior sort of class. Like, that gene, it's almost a gene. It's not in every it's not in every human being, for sure, and it's not even in every man. Like, it's a small subset, and it's special. And I there's another part in the book that I'm thinking now is, I say, could you imagine in the feudal times? Because I do a whole like section on defending feudalism as a superior form of social governance than democracy, which basically anything is better than democracy. Maybe not communism, but kind of like that sort of shit I put in the same bucket. Like, I call it equalitarianism in the book. But I talk about, like, could you imagine one of these blue-haired fucking hippies during the samurai age, like during the feudal Japanese age, going and gluing their fucking hand on the Takaido Road where the samurais are going past? Well, No, you can't for just two reasons.
Right off.
Exactly. So for one, they'd be decapitated. But for number two, like it wouldn't even happen because there was a level of duty, respect, and reverence embedded within the society. So that's why you didn't have these fucking blue-haired hippies sticking their hands on the road, right? So this kind of stuff, it's these are all symptoms of a deeper sickness. And I make a huge argument actually in the book. And this is actually one of the things that will probably jolt Bitcoiners reading this book. I actually make the argument that it's the upstream problems are not all related to the money. And a bunch of them have to do with basically the erosion of, how do I put this delicately?
You don't have to you know, candy coat this. This is
skip the sugar, man. Go straight to the salt.
Go for it.
Okay. It's the erosion of men being in charge, basically. Simple as that. Like as soon as we opened up and, you know, made universal suffrage and all this sort of shit, and it wasn't even just like women's suffrage, but it was giving everybody the vote. I've got this whole section in the book about like Rhodesia. And you know, this one always like rubs me in an interesting way because I've done just my own private like reading of a lot of Wilbur Smith's work, which is historic fiction about the founding of South Africa in particular. And one of the books sort of veers into the story of Rhodesia. And then as I did some more research there, I really discovered what the reality of that story is. And, you know, you have Bitcoiners walking around with these, you know, $1 million, $1 billion, $1 trillion Zimbabwe notes, right? And they'll be like, see, Zimbabwe collapsed because they printed money. What they don't fucking realize is Zimbabwe was the collapse long before they printed the money. Zimbabwe was Rhodesia beforehand, and Rhodesia was the breadbasket of an entire continent. It was one of the most lightly populated countries. It was landlocked, but it was sophisticated, advanced, prosperous, and it was, as I said, the breadbasket of an entire fucking continent before, basically, unfortunately, the commies got in there, so Red China and USSR, and the fucking United States and the UK partnered with the commies, and they embargoed their own ally in Rhodesia at the time, and they basically sealed their fate and put, you know, this is how Mugabe took power. And what was unique about Rhodesia was that they were the last traditional republic or state in which only the landed people had a vote. So you needed to have a certain threshold of property in order to have a say in politics. And at the time, and this is a massive story that, you know, like basically 99.99999% of Bitcoiners are completely fucking oblivious to. And it drives me crazy when they walk around with their stupid $1 trillion Zimbabwe note thinking that fucking they figured it out with the money printer. It's not the fucking money printer. It was the destruction of the structure in which it was the propertied who chose where and what happened with the resources in the country. And when that was torn apart, when that was ripped apart, the country fell apart. And that's what then led to the dumbass Mugabe. Basically, like, you know, they killed off all the white farmers. They did all the atrocities that they did. Then they ran out of fucking money. And their solution to running out of money and to running out of food was to print money. Fucking morons, right? So that comes later. That's like, it's basically the equivalent is eating seed oils all your life, then getting cancer, then getting chemo. The chemo kills you, and it's like it was the chemo. Well, no, it was seed oil. So there's something upstream, right? So I think this is another thing I talk about in the book, which, as I said, it's going to be a very un-Bitcoin of me to say that there's other things than just the money printer that are at cause.
The only thing that I want to say is don't worry. I don't think you should be worried about the un-Bitcoin thing. There's a lot of conversations in the Bitcoin space that I think all four of us here will agree that like need to be had, like, mm-hmm. outside of like, oh, like let's fix the money. It's like, yeah, we can fix the money, but there's a lot of other problems we have to fix, mm-hmm. too at the same time that like money can play a role in, but it's not just a Bitcoin or a fiat thing. Like there, mm-hmm. There's a lot more to this problem than just money.
Mm-hmm. So, amen.
Yeah, setting a trend is never fun, right? Like you when you've got to take all the slings and arrows. But I think this is the space for it, and I think the space needs it. So kudos to you for not only writing the book, but for having the guts to put it out there. It takes a much bigger man to sit there and say, you know what, this is what I think. I'm going to say it, and I've got a lot of research to back it up, and history as well. You know, I want to be real cognizant of your time here, Alex. I know we only got you for about another minute, not even that now. But I want to say thank you first and foremost for doing all of this and then sharing it with this crowd. I'm super excited to read your book, my man.
Thank you, man. I just want to say also thank you guys for running an incredible show, even though I didn't read any of the preliminary work. Sorry, Randy. My apologies. But seriously, well run. And also, you guys are just fucking awesome, man. This is the kind of stuff that I want to see in Bitcoin. I'm bored of all the other shit. Like this is actually a high quality, high signal conversation, and particularly what you guys are doing outside of the podcast with like bringing men together for those ordeals. That's second to none. So thank you guys for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you.
Our genuine pleasure.
We are going to stick around. Alex, if you need to bow out, we really appreciate your time, my man. And you let us know as soon as that hits, and we'll make sure to broadcast it for you and try to get as many eyes on it as possible. I think this group is going to devour that book and probably have multiple sessions in our little chat rooms and everything else together. So
I'm sure. If for anyone who is thinking when the fuck is it coming out, I've been saying it's coming out next month for the last 12 months. almost next month, I think. So we're on the final stretch now. I put a monster day in today, like restructuring things. Probably for the next week or two, we're still in the final parts of the edit. If I'm lucky, it'll be on Amazon by the end of October. So that's kind of the plan. Let's see. For anyone who is interested in pre-ordering it, you can do it on Geyser, and you can do it. I believe the Kickstarter is still accepting late orders as well. So like if you want to get it there.
It is. I literally just did it like as we were booting up this space.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, if you want to spend fiat, go on Kickstarter. If you want to spend Bitcoin, go on Geyser. But yeah, fingers crossed. At the very least, I'm pretty sure it'll be out in November. If I fumble October, or if I have another fucking brain fart of an idea to add into the book. So we'll see. But thank you all. Thank you guys for hosting. Thank you everyone for listening. And yeah, I can't wait to get this out.
See you, ran with us, man.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
We are going to stick around and we're going to talk a little bit, I think probably about this because it was such a great interview and subject, but we thought we'd even throw around a little bit of our ideas on what's about to go down in this abortion of a debate.
Wow. All right. Just hitting the SEO filters like right off the bat.
Man, this, I'll tell you what, I'm tickled, man. I'm really excited to read this book. For Bitcoin veterans to have, a little over a year under its belt, and to have, this core leadership group, and all the OGs that are out there too, that are getting out there and doing things together. To revitalize that warrior mentality, that warrior spirit, the ethos that goes along with it, and what it's going to take to get us through this transition period, which I think it's upon us. People really haven't woken up to the idea. Like, time's short, and I think there's a lot of violence coming, and I think there's just so much to do and prepare for. You're never done, right? You're never done. And the biggest piece of all of this is your network. How's your local community? How's your local family? How's everything within your little proximity? And then, for the guys out there that, if we can share communication and share our thoughts, ideas, the current happenings in our regions, you know, where a lot of the powers that be don't want this kind of stuff shared. How are you doing all these things? We answer a lot of those questions in Bitcoin Veterans, and we're building. And I think that's one of the big things that we are doing is we are building decentralized communication through Freedom Tech. And if you're interested in that kind of thing, it's not the easiest, right? Like this, the warrior's path is not easy. And it takes a ton of study. It takes a tremendous amount of work. And, you know, if you think you got some hobbies now, well, think again, right? Like half of it's going to be reading. And then the other half should probably be practical application and recruiting.
Yeah. If you're complaining about having time, like get plugged into Bitcoin Veterans, you won't have any time anymore. You'll be fine.
Yeah, limber up your brain, man, because you got some work to do. But I mean, that's what it's about. You know, when you get involved in this group of individuals with these psychopaths, you're going to be learning things like you haven't before. I mean, and it's constant, and it's a lot to keep up with. But the fact is, you need to be ready. And you need to be ready right now because it's happening. Okay. Yeah. It is taking place. Okay. And we're going over a waterfall right now and you can't swim back up that thing. Okay. And we're coming into times where there's no other option than to accept the responsibility that is yours and to prepare yourself for what is happening. Okay. And it's not just what's coming. It's happening and it's happening now. And if you're not looking around and if you're not seeing what's taking place around you, then it's time to wake up and it's time to recognize what is taking place and it's time to take action. And the most important thing that you need to start doing, if you're not doing it yet, is start paying attention to what your own standards are. Start paying attention to the group of people that you are a part of and what standards they are holding you to, because it's like we were talking about earlier, if you're surrounded by a bunch of people that are telling you that you're great just the way that you are, they're lying to you because you are not, okay? You are not perfect the way that you are. The fact is you could be a whole lot better. And the more important fact is you know it. So do something about it, all right? If you need someone to give you a pep talk, give me a holler, man. I'll make you feel like total shit until you decide to change something about yourself. But
shame
I'm doing,
shame him, Gabe.
I will shame the hell, but you'll be better for it, all right? And I expect the same in return. Okay, I need it. I need people to tell me where I'm messing up. I need people to tell me where I can improve because I know that the list is extensive. But yeah, this is it, guys. We're here, and this is what all of our moments before have led us up to. So the good news is none of us are on our own. And if you are on your own, you need to cut that shit out, and you need to get involved. So, yeah, that's my couple of sats before we jump into anything about this debate, because I don't even know, man. We were talking about it on the spaces this morning. For those that don't know, Bitcoin Veterans now has a daily spaces on Twitter/X at 10 o'clock in the morning. Just go to the Bitcoin Veterans handle. But yeah, we were talking a little bit about the debate this morning, and there were some interesting takes on it. So yeah, I don't want to jump into it in the beginning of the conversation, but well, I don't know. What do you guys think? Are you going to be watching it?
Yeah.
I'm going to torture. How can you not? Right?
It's going to be that.
Well, I mean, train wreck. You know, yeah. I mean, besides train wreck, the hilarity of I don't really care who any of the viewers' like allegiances or affiliations are, but the hilarity that I saw a statistic that like somewhere around 60 to 70% of whoever this polled population was believe that Kamala Harris is going to come out and crush Trump. I was just like, no.
Oh God. She is the most manufactured candidate in history. And that's saying something because Biden spent his entire run in a basement during COVID. And if you don't understand who runs media, right? Like who runs the media? There is about six organizations and they're all run by the same people. If you understand what they've done in terms of a 180 degree turn, right? Like she was absolutely nobody. She got crushed by Tulsi in the last debate. she has been incredibly inept. And they've said, I mean, Joe Scarborough, for God's sakes, is on record talking about how inept she is. If Joe Scarborough thinks you're inept, I got news for you. Then you go from zero to hero because, you know, she can take the money that Biden, you know, has raised. And now she's the candidate because she's got the greatest possibility of a giant war chest. And that's your hope and opportunity. And the entire media organization flips for you and goes, oh, yeah, hey, we've run this poll and this poll. First of all, polls are bullshit. Polls are absolute propaganda to get people to think a certain way and condition them.
They polled 10 people.
Yeah, it doesn't. And they were all trannies.
And they paid them.
Yeah. Right. But to think that she's not going up there with an earpiece, she's been at this for a minimum of 5 days. And I think Trump is absolutely going to have his day with her. There's no amount of prep for this lady that can possibly do it. And then honestly, I wouldn't put it over the chaos agents that are out there to go out there and do something to make this event not happen.
Wouldn't that be something? Yeah. And it's, as far as her preparation goes, she's been working with a Trump impersonator, having mock debates with this individual. So I guess they spray tanned somebody and gave him a wig and had him yell at her about stuff.
But, Mr. Garrison.
Somebody was, I think it was Jordan earlier. He said that they should have put in Shane Gillis in there.
Oh yeah.
But think about that. I mean, think about where her mind is right now. Think about the level of pressure that she is under. And I was thinking, you know, actually Lisa Huff was saying that, one of the best things that Trump could probably do is just stand there and just be completely quiet. And just let her just do whatever, or to take a saying from an old salt that they used one time was just let her get out there and step all over her own dick and stay out of the way. Okay. I mean, go for it. Cause I mean, if she talks long enough, she's going to reveal undeniably how stupid she actually is.
Yeah. Which is.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, which is perfect because Trump learned that. From the last election cycle, he talked too much and didn't let Biden dig his own grave.
Yeah.
And the last debate, he let it. He was just like, all right, I'm just going to let this like modafinil, Adderall, like lubed up freaking comatose zombie of a moron just continue. He's not even tripping over his own dick at that point. Like he's literally digging his own grave.
Yeah.
Maybe with his dick. I don't know.
And he did too. I mean, shortly after that, what they say in a week, he will not be the presidential nominee anymore.
That was it for him. And the thing was, remember there was a rule where they muted the microphone of the person who wasn't speaking. And that was the worst thing that they could have done to Joe Biden. And you'll notice that they changed the rules for this one, and there are no mutes on the microphones. So they're opening up the door, hoping that Trump will continue to interrupt and look like a bully. And so she can say, stop it, I'm talking right now. Yeah. Like she did in that, you know, that famous moment where she's
talking, I'm talking.
Exactly. Ugh. So, yeah, I want to see a picture of the crowd. And I want to see Tulsi Gabbard sitting down there looking at her doing this.
Done, bitch.
Exactly.
Well, you know, one of the things that besides primarily the stuff that you brought up, Gabe, with like the weirdness of the transition from supporting Biden to supporting Kamala.
Yeah.
There was a lot of rumors in the transitionary period between that, which was probably like 18 months. There was a period for a while where I was hearing rumors on spaces in particular of like political pundits coming in and talking about how there was a lot of animosity and frustration within the Biden campaign because they were wanting Harris to just like get out of the way, right, for the campaign. And she just refused to because she knew her position. She was like, no, I'm not getting out of the way. I don't care what you guys think of me. Like, maybe I still want the possibility of gaining the presidential spot. And then it just so happened that because they didn't like pay attention to how stupid and incapable Biden is, that once he had the absolute travesty of debate with Trump and the embarrassment was put on the world stage, they're like, okay, hey, Harris, like let's revisit that conversation that we had.
It can't be as bad as Biden's performance.
I mean, what happens though?
I think tonight is going to test that.
Yeah, I agree. And what happens? I mean, seriously, anything could happen. It's live. Obviously, there'll be a delay. But what happens if she just like completely and totally bombs this thing, and like to the point where she faints on the stage and like pees on herself? I mean, what do they do if she complete, or if she just starts hurling obscenities at him in a drunken rampage? What are they?
I hope because wouldn't the clips will be perfect.
I mean, either way, tomorrow on Twitter, I mean, there's going to be some entertaining content out there, man, because I know the memesters, they're just sitting there waiting like that dude behind the tree to jump on in all over that gobbly content and do something fun with it, because, I mean, she's going to drop some fun stuff tonight. I know she is.
Yeah, and Trump's the only thing Trump has to do, going to be the hardest thing for them in the world, is show some class, right? Show some class and shut the fuck up. That's all you got to do tonight, man. Don't say shit while she's talking. let her say everything she wants to say, and the world's going to see absolutely what a bimbo this lady is. What a DEI presidential candidate the Democrats have put up, just like every other piece of trash they have, man. It's at this point, it's I have so many thoughts.
When's it supposed to start? In the next like 15?
9 o'clock or so.
9 o'clock? Okay, I thought it was like 8:45 or something.
Yeah, so we got a little bit of time. Everybody can go out there, get their popcorn ready, you know, grab an extra beer or whatever you're gonna do tonight to kind of dull this out. You might as well. And that's the thing, is I don't know how much it matters. At the end of the day, I don't think anybody's coming to save us. And you know, whether it's Trump or her. I will tell you, you know, the fact that you got a Kennedy and a Trump together talking about Bitcoin, that's the one thing I think that is a defining issue for a lot of people in this group. And I don't know, at least I guess you can say they got that going for them.
Amazing times, no doubt.
Go ahead, Mike.
I was gonna say, like, honestly, I don't think there's really anything else that's being talked about for this debate other than just like how much of a, like, it's literally going to be like a deer getting hit by a semi on the highway.
Over and over and over.
Like, I don't know if anybody like in the audience, like if you guys haven't seen like what happens to a deer when a semi hits it, when it's going 80 on Interstate 80, like there's the pink mist from a sniper hitting a headshot. And then there's the pink mist from an entire body exploding because of like a multi-ton vehicle just hit you going 80 miles an hour. I think it's going to be that. Just over, like you were saying, over and over. Or at the very least, just like right out the gate, just splat. And then it's just like everyone's just like got hangover from it afterwards.
I think she might have a couple of zingers. She might have a couple. It might take a second for the semi to get there.
Yeah.
But I want to see the moment in her eyes when she recognizes, just like the deer's eyes when they recognize, oh shit, this is it, I'm done.
Yeah,
that's gonna be interesting.
You think it comes before or after she rambles about time and community?
Yeah,
the problem is her delivery. She has no delivery, no timing, no likability. Like, I'm not saying she's Hillary Clinton unlikable, but she's maybe one notch above.
She can't string words together into a coherent thought.
That's true. At least Hillary understood international politics.
Yeah, at least she can read a book like Rules for Radicals. She knows how to use that.
At least she knows how to remove her enemies, right?
Well, yeah. You gotta respect your enemy in some way, right?
Oh, man. All right, fellas. Why don't we wrap this thing up? Anything, any last comments?
No, other than I'm super excited to read Alex's book.
Hell yeah, man. That was a great conversation. I'm glad we had him on.
Yeah.
Third
time's a charm. Mm-hmm. All right. This has been Bitcoin Veterans. We do this every Tuesday night, 7:30 p.m. Or I should say, we get together at 7 and 6:30. Golly, Shane. 6:30 Eastern. And we do pre-show, and then we start live at 7. So if you guys want to catch us here next week, I think we've got a off week for a guest, and it'll just be the guys hanging out talking, probably – maybe still talking a little bit about this. Who knows what's going to be in the news cycle?
Which is all the viewers' favorite episodes anyway. So You guys can look forward to that.
Make sure if you're out there and you need more Bitcoin veterans, they host spaces every day, 10 o'clock Eastern. Fantastic group of guys and gals get on there, and it's more interactive. So if you want to do a little more interacting, go out there, check those guys out, give them a follow. And I tell you what, Coleman's doing a great job hosting that thing now. So this is what we're talking about, is growing these guys and taking on new positions. If you want it, come get it. That's how Bitcoin veterans work. You can go check it out at bitcoinveterans.org if you want to get plugged in. And until next week, we'll see you then. See you. Yeah.